Welcome to the Something More podcast with me, Jamie Haxby, Steve Carmer, and Josh Fox.
You know, in such a crazy time of change and uncertainty, where all of our values have been flipped upside down, we're going to explore what it means to be truly human.
We are looking at what it means to live fully human with identity, security, and purpose.
And we're going to do that by interviewing loads of different people about their stories, the connection that they have with God.
To find out, in their own life, how have they found something more in relation to understanding and knowing who God is?
Well, because it's upsetting for some, do you know what I mean? But where the cell wall cut, there was a gap and you could hear other people in other cells. And so my first night, I'm there, 16-year-old kids, and I can hear these people crying, these new kids who have come in. And I'm hearing them crying and I'm like, Should I be crying, thinking like I need to go home and it's a bad thing and blah blah blah. And I thought,
hey guys, it's Steve Carmer from the Something More podcast. I'm joined today by Lancashire's best love Scouser. So send out some love to Davy La Hyam. And guys, you can do us a quick favor before we kind of get into this interview properly. You could smash out some love for Dave Hyam. You could also share this post. It would be really good if you do that. So what we are able to do is to get it out to as many people as we possibly can. Tech people, I hope you can see that my microphone is as close as I can possibly get it. So don't you be giving me any grief about audio issues, but I do have to say that we did have some technical difficulties. So I am seriously missing you. And Dave is just as bad at tech as I am. Dave.
Not that bad, Steve.
Not as bad as having this big pop star mic.
Dave,
let me begin by just asking you a couple of questions. Let me just give some big shout outs as well. Hey, Kerry Hyam, how you doing? That's your missus. Kenny Mayo's watching. Ollie J, OJ, we love you. Jane May, Anne Garrett. I hope Bill's watching as well. Chris Hargreaves, Catherine, and anybody else who is watching. My boy, Peter Flynn. Dave, how do you know Peter Flynn from church?
Oh yeah, we go back. He knew Kerry, my wife. They've gone back a very long time, and then through Kerry, I met Peter about 14, 15 years ago, I think it was. So good man, Peter is.
Peter's a legend, right? You know, at church, we wear these kind of black T-shirts. I love them, right? And the only person who's allowed to have a red T-shirt is Peter Flynn. Nobody else is allowed any other color, but Peter Flynn's allowed a red one because we love Peter. He's a legend.
He's special. He's special and different, isn't he, Pete? He's just special.
He's a legend. So I'm going to just begin by some light questions. I'm going to get my water over here so I can drink it. I asked someone who knows you very well to do a little bit of sneaky, beaky intelligence on you. Now, I'm going to ask you some questions. You do not have to answer these questions, but anything that you do not say might be used against you in the court of law or something along those lines.
It was sounding familiar, that.
I think you got it wrong. It's been a long time since I've been arrested, but there you go. We're here to talk about you. So listen, when I ask you these questions, I also need you to figure out who this person is. So, and guys, if you are commenting in, I want to see what you think about these questions too. So here goes. Here's the first one. Dave, do you have a superpower? And if so, what is that superpower? Now, I'm going to repeat that because if you've got any comments or you guys want to stick in there, make sure you're getting it in. Have you got a superpower? And if so, what is your superpower?
Have I got a superpower? Wow. I find it difficult to answer that. I think the only power I've got is my story, and you know, hopefully me sharing my story you know, that power goes out to others to help others to instill change and hope. Because when someone shared their power, their story, it enabled me to break free from addiction and crime. So my power is my story, my experience.
That's not what they said. They said you do have a superpower, and they said Dave's superpower is he gets where water can't, which you have to explain that, because I was like, I'm a pastor, I can't say that. And he wins every round. So explain that, and you're probably figuring out who said it already, but he gets where water can't and he wins every round. What does that mean?
Well, he gets where water can't. It's usually like a term for Scousers. They get where water can't. Every prison you go across the country, you'll find a Scouser. And if there's a way in, we'll find it. I think that saying I use quite often, I'm racking my brains who that is, to be fair. But I do have that saying where I get where water can't, or you get where water can't. So you find yourself in opportunities and stuff like that. I can't remember what the next one after that was. But
and you win every round of what?
The thing is, I'm just resented all the time for being good at sports. And it's like, it's not my fault. I'm just good at table tennis. I beat all the guys. Yeah, you know, a friend of mine, Carl, he still thinks he's better than me, but he's not. And it's like, you know, these people. I had Yak Patel, the chief exec of the CVS, saying, "Oh, I'm great at table tennis." So I said, "Get down the well on the weekend." So he comes down the well, and it's you know, about 21-0. You know what I mean? It's like, I can't help being good at sports.
So listen, if you want to challenge Dave at table tennis, you better bring it, because he wins every round. Here's the second thing I asked them. I said, what are the three most important things to Dave Higham? And they said,
my family, my wife, and my kids.
They said family, God, and golf, and the position of these are interchangeable.
Yeah. Who's that?
It is the same person. Peter Flynn is laughing at you. Oh,
you've talked to Kerry. You've been talking to Kerry.
Kerry who?
Kerry, I am my wife.
I cannot confirm or deny. Okay, two more questions, and then we will get talking about your story. This is going to give it away. What drives Dave Higham nuts?
Kerry, no. what drives me nuts? I think Kerry, when she doesn't clean her coffee mug after when I go to make her a cup of coffee in the morning. I don't know. Go on. Have you got an answer for me?
Since he turned 50, everything drives him nuts.
Yeah, I've got Natalie lately.
You've got what?
Natalie. Apparently, I seem to moan at everything now. I think that might be coming with age.
Like Victor Meldrew?
Yeah. I just seem to be moaning a lot. I seem to have an opinion on everything these days.
Yeah, well, I'm a bit opinionated. I try not to be, but I am. Here's the final one. I was like, tell me something that I don't know about Dave Higham. Again, guys, if you know something that we don't know about Dave Higham, make sure you stick it in the comment section below.
Okay.
Well, this is what they told me. Dave believes that he could have played for Everton one day.
I did not. Liverpool.
They did say Liverpool. And they said, your nickname, and you've got a tattoo, is Dave Emo Higham. You've got to explain that.
Imo. And it was short for I am, because you used to get called I am, and it was just in Liverpool, everything gets shortened down. So it's either I am, Imo, H, or D. Do you know what I mean? It just gets shortened. Whatever the name is, it'll get shortened as much as. So it's just a name from a nickname, just from me last name, Imo. But it's sort of like, I'm only ever known in my bad days as Imo. You know what I mean? Is you know, I'm just known as Imo. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was just a bit of fun. Catherine Stanley said, us left-handers are natural athletes.
I'm left-footed. Yeah, left-footed, oh. Right-hand.
Yeah, tell me about Liverpool. So you were. I'm going to put my tablet down here because that's all of the questions which I was going to ask from this. But you were that good at football.
Yeah, I like to think so. Yeah, I was good, and I loved playing. And you know, my cousins. It was usually me uncle John and our Stephen and our Paul who was like encouraging me and saying you're good and do something and all that. But I think the pull to the other way of life was much more. But I often wondered, you know, where it could have gone, because every like prison I've ever been in, I've gone straight into the football team. I've won trophies. I've met famous people in prison because of playing football and stuff like that. So yeah, I was left footed as well. So I always go to Kerry. You know, in the 80s. That missing left fielder for England should have been me. But there you go.
Yeah, yeah. And Liverpool was quite some force in the 80s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. You know, I was born in Cantrell Farm and I was there till 1970 to 1980. And, you know, that was classified as one of the worst estates in Europe. I didn't seem to think so. It was like it was a real community spirit, I thought. And then in 1980, we moved to Kirkdale. So from Cantrell Farm to Kirkdale was a big transition because it was a small council estate we lived on, surrounded by farms and woods. Excuse me. And then to move to Kirkdale, which is one of the worst areas in Liverpool as well. You know, it was all like lights and streets and shops, and it was like, wow, it was like Blackpool to me.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's when things went a bit funky for me.
So, why don't you begin by just telling us a little bit about your childhood? And obviously some of these guys are a little bit younger than yourself and myself. We both use Oil of Olay, so we only look 25, but we're a little bit older. You're a little bit older than me, actually. You're 10 years older than me. I just thought I'd point that out. Not that I'm self-conscious. But tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, because Liverpool had a bit of a reputation for issues with race, issues with unemployment, issues with heavy policing, drugs, crime, the kind of big city problems. So tell us about Liverpool growing up and tell us how it was for you personally.
Yeah, I think growing up in Liverpool, it was like, I think it was survival mode. It was, you only ever really dealt with fights. You only dealt with things and issues with fighting, and that went right back, you know, to me parents. It was like, you know, it was just fights. That's how you dealt with things. And it was like, if there was an issue, you had a fight, and you fought, and sometimes after time you were mates afterwards, but you would always get there. Even people's mums and dads, you know, if there was an issue, you'd say, right, sort it out, and then you'd end up fighting with the kids, and that was in Cantrell Farm. You know, I remember having many fights there growing up, but I also remember really some good times. Do you know what I mean? Because we were surrounded by woods, and my playground was the woods, so I used to just go into the woods and with my mates, and we used to just collect eggs. We would do all kinds of tasks in terms of running over ditches and making bow and arrows and darts. We used to make these throwing darts with a nail in that you could throw for ages. So I have some fond memories of Canton Farm. It felt like safe. It felt like a real community spirit, although you could have a fight, but that was just part and parcel of it. I don't ever remember walking around in fear or that hypervigilance that in the streets anyway, that something was gonna go off. And and we come from Notton, we never had Notton, and there was seven of us in a three-bedroom council house, masonette. So you did borrow things from neighbours, and neighbours looked after each other, and there was fights with neighbours. My mum's fought over me loads of times when, you know, I've had a fight with a lad, and his mum's gone to batter me. I'd go and tell my mum, and my mum would go and sort it out. You know what I mean? So it was that. It was just that rough and ready, you know, kind of area. And that's what it was like in Cantrell Farm. And then we moved to Kirkdale, and
is that more urban then? Because the only area I know in Liverpool is Chinatown and Toxteth. That's the only two areas. Liverpool is actually one of my favourite cities. Do you know that? I absolutely love Liverpool. Yeah. And this is going to give you a big head. I love Scousers as well. You guys are characters, and you know, I grew up in Scotland. There's quite a close connection between Scotland and Liverpool. I'm a Celtic fan, so we sing "You Never Walk Alone" as well. Yeah. And so there's quite a close connection. So, but I don't know Liverpool that well. So you moved from that first place, which sounded.
So there was an overspill from Liverpool, in Liverpool in the 1970s, 60s going into 70s, and there was a big overspill. So they built these estates in these other areas. So one was Cantrell Farm, I think. The other one was Skemsdale. So they just built them on the rim of Liverpool. But in Cantrell Farm, it was just it's a small area surrounded by farmlands. It's next to Highton. And so you never really come out of Cantrell Farm. Once you were in there, you were in there. So there was no real, like, bus routes out of town. There was one bus that come in and come out, I think it was the 12. So, you know, and... So all the it was just an overspill, and you know, people just got launched there, basically. Do you know what I mean? And so that was sort of like on the rim of Liverpool, and then Kirkdale is next door to Liverpool's ground and Everton's ground, so it's sort of in between these two grounds. So we moved in 1980, and it was a big culture shock to me. It was like, from being so we only had a mobile in Cantrell Farm, just one mobile. It was a van, and they sold goods from the back of this van. You went to the mobile, and that's how it was. But then you moved to Kirkdale, and we moved on to a private estate then. So I think my dad had started his own business and started doing all right. So he got an house on a private estate, and it was half built.
What was your dad doing?
So my dad was a builder. He'd been milkman, he'd been different odd jobs, and then, you know, he'd gone into building and doing so he's a good joiner. He was a good bricky, so he went into his own business and started doing building work. And so when we moved there, the playground was a lot bigger, and the playground weren't the woods. It was shops, and it was empty houses and stuff like that. And then, you know, I had to move school when I was in the third year juniors. I was 10 when I moved, so I had I had just under a year left in this juniors, and I went to St. John's. I was new in the school, and so people were
so you're a Catholic?
Yes, Catholic.
You're from a Catholic family. I thought so with seven brothers and sisters, but but also
there's a Liverpool background as well, Scottish background in our family as well. So you know, I'm just doing some work where it's looking at your family history and some are from Scotland, you know what I mean? So, and on my dad's side, Ireland as well. So, so, you know, again, I got into fights there in Kirkdale because I was the new guy. I sort of like started falling into bunking off school at that time as well. Started bunking off school, started taking gas and glue.
Is that where you started? Because like a lot of people start with cheap cider or weed. Did you start strutting the gas then?
Yeah, I've never talked to the ale, the alcohol. I've never really liked the taste of it. And I just never liked the taste of it. I remember one New Year's Eve, I didn't even know how you drink successfully. So we sneaked in a party and there was just all these shorts. And I just went round all these bottles, all these short bottles, and poured them into this glass, filling it right up and just going bang and swigging it. And I don't remember anything else from that. I believe I was carried home in a comatose and that would have been about 10, 11. So that was my only real experience at drink. It wasn't attracted to me. But, you know, when my mates introduced me to gas and glue, it was like, oh yeah, you know, I was enjoying that kind of stuff at that age. Yeah.
What about your brothers? Were they involved in that sort of stuff, or were you the oldest?
No, I've got an older brother and older sister. I've got two older sisters and an older brother and a younger. And me older sister was sort of, I think she was having a spliff, but spliff and the odd trips here and there, and maybe having a drink as well. But me others, they weren't. So my sister is my close sister, Angela. She's a heroin addict like me as well, and in and out the prison system like me, and still is. We ended up taking heroin together at a young age of 14.
How did things begin to get worse? Because, you know, a number of people, you know, myself included, you know, it's a little bit of fun up until a point, but then there is like sometimes a line. So when did you start crossing that line? Did it go from sniffing a little bit of glue and doing a bit of gas to taking smack?
So or heroin. For me, I never liked being at home. The home at that time. My dad was always working and. I didn't like the home at that time. I won't go too much into it, but it was a bit dysfunctional. There was violence and stuff like that. So my playground was on the streets, and I wanted to be out the house. I hated being in the house. I didn't like it in the house. So I always would be on the streets and in that, you know, when you're out there, you've got to come into so other people like you really who don't want to be at home and want to be on the street. So, you know, it was taking gas and glue, and then you're knocking around with people who are just a little bit older because you are streetwise and stuff like that. You know, I remember, you know, the first time these older lads were taking heroin in 84, and they were older, but they were had like syringes they were injecting. They had, you know, you get your throwaway syringes now, used once. These were glass syringes, and, you know, it was like cool to have a glass, you know, syringe with your heads and stuff like that. And it was like, I didn't inject or nothing like that, but the it was introduced, and you could buy a bag of heroin for £5. I remember having one spliff, and I didn't agree with me. It just made me feel paranoid and I didn't like the feeling of it, so I weren't really into it. And I don't think I went straight from gas glue to heroin then, do you know what I mean? And it was like, Yeah, they give me a go. I remember we used to jump on the train, bunk the train, and just sit on the train chasing this the gear on the foil. And I remember going sick everywhere, and I didn't know I was on heroin at the time. I just knew it was called gear. I was taking this gear, and it was crap at first, but I've done it to fit in with the lads I was with. I wanted to be liked. I wanted to fit in. You know, I went sick a few times and I just carried on because they were carrying on, and they would get pocket money and stuff like that. I never got a penny. You know, I never had pocket money. I never had like hobbies. And that was one of the reasons like I never got into football, because I never got bought all the gear, the football boots and all what you need. So it was like I ended up going for trials in a pair of school shoes. And I just felt so embarrassed and this never went back. So I think apart from everything else, that weren't there, do you know what I mean? So I used to go shoplifting to get stuff and sell stuff so we could buy drugs, breaking into cars, because on the match day we used to mine cars on Liverpool and Everton. And then you drop some of them, do you know what I mean? And I got my first arrest at 14 as well.
Was that for breaking into a car, burglary? Yeah.
Yeah, it was breaking into a car, shoplifting, that's how it started for me. So I was shoplifting and. Because I couldn't get money, I didn't get pocket money and stuff like that, or couldn't get money off family. That was my way of earning, and that's what I've done.
And like I said, I grew up in Scotland. I was saying to my wife, Abigail, I probably went to about 8 primary schools before I went to Scotland. And I moved to Scotland when I was about 6-7 years old. No, sorry, I went to about 8, including in Scotland, but... But and the Scottish legal system is different from the English legal system. But one thing that happened in Scotland was not a lot happens to you until you reach the age of 16. So often, you know, drug dealers will use younger kids. Were you involved in pushing drugs?
No, not at that age. In 84, it was like, you sold from your house. It's not like it is now. So... You know, we used to go to the Earlham Estates, used to Bootle, the Triangle, and you used to go on it. It was very dangerous to go on these estates and score drugs for crocky, because there was people just like sitting off waiting for you to come on the estates with your money, and then you would be had off. So, you know, you'd have to be careful and stuff like that. And me at 14, I looked about 10. You know, I tried to score the gear at 14 and he knocked me back and said, go away, you're a kid. Do you know what I mean? So I couldn't really even get it at that age. It was other people. So, it was different. So I used to have to go to flats and you'd have cages on the front door. One of them used to call it the hole, and they knocked the brickwork out next to the front door. So this is someone's flat, and they've knocked the brickwork out of the wall to make a little hole, a little square hole where you put your money through, because the doors were barricaded up and everything else. And the gear purity was really high. You got a lot of it. It was only £5 and... And I remember asking my sister one day, and she thinks she got me on it, and I think I got an ear on it, so who knows. But I remember asking her to buy it one day, and she bought a bag, and we shared it with my mates, and then I remember her becoming a heroin addict as well.
Tell me about, you know, issues with the police and the crime. And, you know, so did it begin with kind of youth offenders institutions, and how did that all happen?
So I got arrested. I remember getting arrested and the police calling me, because I was too young. You had to get your parents. And I remember my mum coming in the police station and saying, Mrs. Iam, your son's on heroin. And I went, no, I'm not. I said, I'm on the gear. And he went, no, heroin is the gear. And it was like, and that was the first... like reality, because you're only seeing these adverts. Oh, I've just got a cough and a cold, I can deal with it, and Zamo on the telly and Grange Hill and all them things. But it didn't faze me. I'd go out and I'd rob commercial shops, I'd rob the shops and stuff like that. And I remember being arrested for car theft, for burglary, for theft out of sheds. I weren't a big time criminal. And I remember having to go to court and my dad had to take me. And I went with a car key, because I said, well, when we get to town and we come out of the court, we'll rob a car and get off and go and do some graft. So I've got this car key and I've gone with this girl and this lad who were graft with me dad as well. And so I give them the key and went in the court. I said, I'll be out in a minute. And as I've walked in, they've said, right, Mr. Ryan, we're going to give you the short, sharp shock and we're sending you now to Foster Hall Detention Centre for 3 months. And it was like, what? You know, this is age 16. And it was like, what the hell? Do you know what I mean? And they just put the cuffs on me and took me away.
And what was that like, you know, because I'm keeping an eye on the comments here as well. Kenny Mayo, I'll just put that here. Kenny said that jail is where he picked up his addiction. So what was it like going in for the first time? You know, youth offenders institutions have got a reputation for people who are trying to prove themselves, unlike prison, where some people just want to do their bird and get out of there. What was it like? And did it start to become, I've got in way over my head at that point?
Not really. I just, you know, when you, before you go, you know, people who have gone, you don't let anyone take the pee out of you. Don't, you know, don't be bullied. Don't be this. If you are, you'll be this and that. And they always went in the attitude, no one's going to take me for a divvy. No one's going to bully me because I don't like bullies. So that's not going to happen. And I remember going in and I had severe psoriasis as well. I've had it from 12. So that was another hindrance I had to carry in terms of getting into fights. If anyone called me a name, I'd have to get into fights with them. But I went in here and the lad's telling me, they have someone, a con working in the reception area telling you like, yeah, mate, you need to take your clothes off and get stripped down naked and then put the shirt here and put these clothes. And he's telling me, and I said, who are you talking to, lad? Don't tell me to get me clothes off. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, it's my job, mate. It's just my job. It's like, so I'm hyper vigilant now. Do you know what I mean? I'm waiting for something to happen. And I remember if you didn't say sir, then you know you got slapped. And I remember them saying, right, sign this. I went, all right. And he went, slap across the face. You say sir when you talk to me. So it was a more like army mentality, and they made you march, they made you know, fitness and stuff like that. So I went in and they put you for the first night, they put you in a cell on your own.
That's really good.
Well, because it's upsetting for some, do you know what I mean? And but where the cell wall come, there was a gap and you could hear other people in other cells. And so my first night, I'm there, 16-year-old kids, and I can hear these people crying, these new kids who have come in. And I'm hearing them crying, and I'm like, should I be crying here? Like, should I be crying, thinking, like, I need to go home, and it's a bad thing, and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, and I tried to make myself cry at that time, and I just couldn't. And it was like, you didn't, this is where you are. Get on with it, sort of thing. And there was fear there because I didn't know what to expect. And this is where they made you do bed packs, and you know, you had to do like squares, and you had to fold your t-shirts into squares and made them all, you know, in line. And you couldn't have them hanging over. If they were hanging over, they'd just pull them or throw your bed all over the place. And you know, now as to this day, I fold my t-shirts the way I did in Foster Hall in Borstal in 1986. I still fold my t-shirts like that square. And
I served in the military, and we used to take people on 3-day courses that were called personal development courses, and that's the sort of stuff we used to do. We used to chuck their bedding out the window.
And... a coin off your bed and bounce it off and see if it was tight and taut and all that. But after like 3 days in there, I just settled in and it was like, yeah, I felt all right.
Were there drugs available in there?
Not really. You couldn't smoke. It was tight. In Foston Hall it was anyway, and it was like, it was really strict. And I'm used to the only thing you could get away with really was robbing stumps or smuggling a cigarette in. And you used to sell. You used to get a match, and you used to get a razor blade, and you'd cut the match into four pieces, so you would have four matches out of one. So you'd do a slice down the middle, and then a triangle shape, and that would give you four matches, and you'd sell them for 30 pence for a piece of the match, and then you'd get a pound for the rollie, and you'd use the Bible. We used to get the Bible, and it was really good for the cigarette paper. So we'd rip the Bible and roll it, and it's a bit funny now you're doing that, but you'd get the Bible and roll it and smoke the Bible with the tobacco, and you would try and just get away with that, robbing the screw stumps or anything like that, and that was in Foston Hall, and I was there for like a month, I think I was there, and then it was at that time there was refugees coming in, and he wanted everyone out of Foston Hall prison to let these refugees in, and he said, right, yous are going to Nottingham. So everyone who was in Foston Hall was like 17 or under, 18 or under or something like that, and but in Nottingham it was 18 or under, and then they had an 18 to 21 year old like that, and it was like, you go in there and they were going, you scousers are going to get done in when you get here, and we were like, oh shit. So I'm thinking, oh, we're going to get it. So I'm like, that, listen lads, let's have it, we stick together and doing all this, that and the other. And I remember walking in, seeing big fellas with tattoos on their head, tattoos on the face, on the neck, on the lips, on their eyelids, you know, and it was like, and they were like the mostly the 18 to 21, and we were had to go and get our food from them, and one of them went, any effing scousers come here, you're getting battered. And we were like, oh, thank God that, like, we're on the younger side, you know what I mean? And they put us in a dorm together, and there's a lad called Paul Becklam, he works for Lancashire Sports now in East Lancs, and he's still about. We were in the dorm, and you get dorm beats. And what dorm beats is, you'd just say, like, you'd pick on someone and say, like, you're getting a dorm beat tonight. And what you do, you'd all get like shoes in a pillow and just start whacking them with it. And it's crazy to say that's what you've done for fun. You'd beat someone up for fun. But we did. And I remember we were saying we were going to get this lad to do it, and he said, and he stood up and said, anyone comes near me, they're getting wrapped around the head with this chair. So that was a challenge to me then. It was like, definitely I've got to do it more. So I said, Becky, follow me in here. So I just ran and got this lad and started beating him up, and Becky come in, and then I got caught off the screws, and he said, right, you're going down the block, the periods. But he said I was the ringleader, so I lost prison time and stayed down the block, and Becky just lost. He just stayed down the block for a few days and got sent back up.
So the block's solitary for those who
isolation. So 2 days later, when I got back up, they made an announcement to the young people and said to us younguns, and said, right, we're overcrowded here, so there's going to be a few years going over to the adult side. And I've gone, they're going to stitch me up. And there's no, they're going to stitch me up here because they think I'm some sort of ringleader or something. And lo and behold, two people, there was this 6-foot-odd lad. I don't know how he was like 17, but he looked, you know what I mean? And me, little old me there. And they moved us over and they're saying, you're getting it tonight. I'm sitting around all these big lads and saying, wait till you get in the dorm tonight. And it was like, so I had to make a stand there and just sort of jumped up now and grabbed something and said, let's have it, because I'll take one of yours. So I made a bit of a front, a bit of a, like, you know, bravado. And then when I got in the dorm, they were like, all right, Scouse, who should we get tonight? And it was like, right, Sal, let's get in. Boom. And that was my, you know what I mean, my experience of my first year.
So, you know, coming out, you know, did you do the whole things going to change from now on, or did it literally make no difference whatsoever, and kind of pick up your story from that point?
So I thought I was going to give up the heroin, and my greatest thinking, my best mind said,
did they put you on like methadone or like a heroin substitute?
You didn't get anything in them, but you never told them you were an heroin addict, because they put you down solitary when you come in and let you just leave you for a week till you do your withdrawal. So I was thinking, when I get out, I'm not going to take heroin. I'm going to smoke cannabis and drink alcohol, and I'm going to rob betting officers. That's what I'm going to do. So I got out, and my sister's fella was a burglar, and he was into smoking weed and drinking. So I gravitated to them for a bit. We did rob a few betting officers, and used to dig the safe out and stuff like that. And I think it was after about a month, it just weren't doing it for me. They was like, oh, come back to me. The heroin, the gear was like, come back to me. And he ended up just like, oh, I'm getting off. And he ended up getting off and falling back into heroin again. And within 6 months, I was back in prison again. I weren't in prison. It was in 1987. I just turned 17, and there was in 87 there was an overcrowding at the prison, so they used to lock us. When you got on me, man, they lock it in police cells. So I was in police cells at 17 for attempted burglary, theft, and something else trivial. But I was in with armed robbers, and on this, like, there was 11 cells with these armed robbers and stuff like that. I think Nobby Styles, Jay Chioki, some other lads from Bootle, and they were saying, right, we're going to escape. And I'm like, shit, what's going on here? It's like, we're going to escape because there's this new copper on who's not really clued up. And when he, because they used to put your milk in the fridge for you, because you were there, you were on remand in these cells, and they give you a telly and left you open and just locked the end of the doors. He said, we're going to send him for milk in his office. And as he goes in his office, the charge door where you get brought in, we'll boot that open. And I'm like, just go along with it. I said, yeah, I'm in. So he knocked on the door. He said, can you get me milk out of the fridge there, boss? And as he's gone in his office, this Jake Chioki's just ran out, volleyed the door open. He went, Nobby went, this other lad went, and the others weren't going anywhere. And I thought, sod it, I'm going. And I just got off with them, and we were on. And we ended up, you know, they wanted to rob a frigging house and call a taxi from there. I said, yeah, I'll sort it. So I went and got a cab, and we got picked up, and I only lasted a day and a half. I was arrested again and back in, and they sent me straight to Risley Prison, which is YPs, but it is absolutely rough as toast.
What YPs is, what, like a young
person's detention prison.
Yeah. But,
you know, if I thought like Foster Knoll was bad, it had nothing on Risley. So my bottle was going, I was scared.
And are you using needles at this point, or?
No.
Still smoking it, okay.
I was just smoking heroin at this time. So I've gone in, and you go into the call, the cage. And the cage is just a big room. And everyone who comes in the prison, or who's been to court or being remanded, all get, like, you know, you might see it on American films, but it's just like one wall of gates and two walls, and everyone. So there are 50 people in there. So the screws open the door and let me in. As I've walked in, I've just seen these two lads just battering and punching this kid everywhere, and I've just thought, oh, I'm getting it. he were throwing food over this lad, pouring cups of tea over him. And I'm just thinking, oh no, how am I going to get through this? How am I going to get through this? And it was like, right, suck it up. And that was like one of the most scariest times for me at that moment, do you know what I mean? It was like, but again, a few days in, you know, I become one of them bullies, really. I had to have a few fights and I'd front people up. And I always got in trouble. So, especially in the YPs, it was sort of like you fought to get a bit of a name for yourself, a bit of a reputation, because it was ruthless. If you showed any weakness, if you showed any vulnerability, boom, you'd home in on it like a Scud missile. And so you had to become, or you would be the victim. And I weren't becoming a victim, and I'd end up like fighting people. And one of my tactics was, if I fight screws, prison officers, these are all going to think I'm mad and stay away from me. So when the screws started to, like, you know, give you a bit of jib, I'd say, you're talking to, don't talk. And bang, and I'd be fighting with them. So people sort of, like, give you a bit of a wide berth and like, included you sort of thing. You become like, because you were becoming an head in there, and you wouldn't take crap off people. And you know, I'd never got any money sent into prison to me. I never had any money. I didn't have anyone really coming to visit me, so I had nothing. And then you can't really have nothing in that environment, because you'll be seen as like a nobody. So I had to go out and bully people, and I'd take the trainees off them. I would take the canteen off them, all the food, all the soap and shampoo. And I'd have a cell full to the brim of shampoo. It was like the King's Palace. And it was all that I just stole off people, do you know what I mean? And it was like, but it gave you some sort of kudos to have a pad like that and a cell like that. And the screws, because you know you'd fight them, sort of give you a bit of a squeeze as well. And so I'd had a couple of fights. And I remember even at 19,
yep,
blagging the age to go to Walton Prison, which is the 21 and older, because I was sent to Hindley then. And if I thought, well, if I get to Walton, I might get a visit off my sister who will bring me drugs in. So I blagged my age to get into Walton Prison. And, you know, I was in there, and then I was arguing with a prison officer, a screw, and then next minute, you know, they let everyone downstairs and kept me behind my door. And then he opened my door and said, right, I am, you're moving. I said, where am I moving? He said, never mind, get your stuff packed. So as I've jumped off my bed to pick my box up to start packing, he's just come in and kneed me in the ribs and then punched me. So I've picked him up and just thrown him on the floor and just hit him. And then, but little did I know, there was like all the screws are outside, and they all just started running in to get me. So I thought, I best grab hold of something because I'm going to get it. So I bit him, I bit his leg, I bit his hand, and just got frog marched and beat up down the block. And I was down the block for isolation again for over a month until I said, look, I'm only 19. I shouldn't even be here. And he was like, oh, get him out. So they sent me back to Inley. And that's how it was for the first good few years of prison. I was only out for 6 months. I was a bad thief. I was an heroin addict. And then the cocaine come in, so I was taking speedballs. I was injecting then. Life just started to spiral out of control.
So Kenny said in Walton for 2 years. Did you ever go to Walton?
Yeah, I was in, I think Kenny's older than me, because in 87 I was in Inley, in 88 I was in Stoke Heath, in 89 I was in Stoke Heath, but I was in every year at that time. So I was only 87, 88 and 89, I was 17, 18 and 19, so I was only still young, really.
So you're now injecting... And I'm getting some feedback from something. I don't know if that's from you or I'm not sure. But, so you're now injecting and you're using cocaine. Now, again, look, we're from different eras and like from different places. When I was growing up, cocaine was really expensive. It was like a rich boy's drug. So like, I can't even remember. It was like 60 quid a gram or something like that. So what was it like down here?
Yeah, it was still known as a rich man's drug, but you know, you could buy it £20 wraps, half a gram. I think it was £40 for half a gram. So
crack was cheap, but heroin was like everywhere in Scotland. But so you're injecting, you're obviously using more drugs, you're using different drugs. Obviously, your drug habit, it's getting more and more costly. You're going in and out of prison. Tell me about when it starts to change. I mean, let me ask one question first, and then we go there. Do you think prison actually works? Do you think prison works? And if so, or if not, why?
No, the breeding grounds for crime. It's a criminal's university. So when I went to prison, I learned how to burgle houses and I learned how to burgle and I got showed with different ways how to do things and how to get behind, how to bypass alarms and this, that and the other. And it was like, so you went there and all you ever talked about was your drug taking and your crimes and what you're going to do when you get out, because it's all bravado. So you start living. So I think in them times, you know, the prison system's changed now, and we're actually going to be doing a live feed ourselves on Friday about prison and does people get well in prison. And it has changed from then, but then it was like there was no methadone. You were just in and it was just survival and no rehabilitation. You got the odd drugs group, but who wants to know information about what drugs are doing to your brain? I'm not bothered. It's like, tell me something I want to, you know, I need to know. It's like, yeah. And they'd say, well, you could die. And I say, well, I welcome death. Death doesn't scare me because my life is just broke. I've got nothing.
So we're going to go there in a minute. Just a quick word from our sponsors. We've put the links to the WOW community in the description bar. After this, make sure you punch like on the WOW community Facebook page. There's also Dave Higham's YouTube page. Make sure you punch like there and you subscribe. And they put out loads of great content. And I've been watching some of their content. I watched one the other day. It was about aces. And I'm not going to tell you what that is, but it's nothing to do with gambling. If you want to know, watch that video. But how did things begin to change? If you know what aces are, you can put that in the comment section below. How did you begin to change? What changed things for you, and when?
Yeah, I think the last 3 or 4 years, my addiction just got out of hand. My mental health deteriorated. I was categorized as a complete flick offender. Mental health issues, drug addiction, the whole shebang, and you know, I was injecting and I couldn't get veins, so it was like it was always difficult to try and get inject because all my veins had collapsed. And I was taking drug after drug after drug, because at one time, at the end of me using, I was taking heroin, crack cocaine, Valium, alcohol, and sleeping tablets, Moggies and Valium, Temazepam, just to function, because I was so absorbed and self-obsessed that I couldn't get out the house. So at first, drugs give me confidence, but over the years, it just took every bit of confidence that I had away, and where I couldn't function without the use of drugs. So when people said to you know, oh, all them drugs, you could die, it was like, oh, I wish they'd hurry up. So I had the gift of desperation. That's what I had. And what that means is like, I was at the limit. So I could either die or break free. Do you know what I mean? That's what it was like. But I lived in that, not knowing I was at the gift of desperation, that I was that desperate to die or to live. But I didn't know how to live because I didn't have the tools and there was no one to show me. And then my last sentence was 4.5 years. And I remember just thinking, God, have I got, because I took drugs in prison like I did on the streets, do you know what I mean? And it was like, I'd take anything, tablets or hooch or whatever it was. So I was still in the same frame of mind, the same chaos. And I just had enough. And I seen the prison system change as well. So I was coming into my 30s, mid 30s, and like the drugs had changed because there was young lads coming in at 21 who were like selling drugs and they were into guns and all this, that and the other. And it was like, and they would walk around in gangs. So usually when you're going off for a straightening and you'd have a fight with someone, that was going out the window. They'd send like 6 or 7 people in to do you in and beat you up and stuff like that, or slash you, or, and some of it was entertainment as well, do you know what I mean? Drugs in prison become, you know, they were the god. If you sold drugs in prison, you were god, you could get anything you want. And I've done the same. I've beat people up for drugs. I've burgled the medical arch or the prison's officer's mesh, whatever it is, to get money for drugs. And so I seen that, so a fear started to come in me that like, I don't know if I can survive in this new environment, do you know what I mean? As an heroin addict, I just don't think. So there was that lingering, and then the thought of like doing 4.5 years, just withdrawing, getting drugs, withdrawing. And then someone suggested I go to Lancaster Castle. There was a 12-step rehab there, and I didn't have a clue what 12-step was. It was like, you could have said it was something off Mars. I don't know. I just didn't have a clue. I'd never seen anyone get well before. People just died or got lifed off or spent a lot of time in prison. You never seen anyone coming around and saying, look, you can get off this stuff. So I just accepted I'd live or, you know, live or die in addiction. And they sent me to Lancaster Castle.
So I mean, Kenny told us what ACEs are, adverse childhood experiences. Yeah. I mean, like, people sometimes think that prison is filled with monsters, and there are some very, very scary people. But there are also a lot of people who have gone through some incredibly difficult things and like some serious mental health issues. I mean, you know, is that what you were seeing all around you as well, or am I just being a little bit kind of tree hugging and stuff like that?
No, it's myself included is. Been through adverse childhood experiences, and what that means is you've either been sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused, neglected, violence, domestic violence, parents taking drugs or alcohol, emotional neglect. Oh, there's 10. And the evidence says if you've had 3 or more adverse childhood experiences, then you're more likely to take drugs, you're more likely to commit crime. And I heard something on the, I'm reading a book called The Body Keeps the Score, really good book to read around adverse childhood experiences. And it gives you, he's sharing all the evidence, and it's factual stuff. That the adverse childhood experience on people's health, so people with mental health issues, people over eating disorder problems, people going to prison, people gambling, sex addiction, drug addiction, due to this adverse childhood experiences, and the evidence is there to say, if you've been through this, then there's a part of your brain that's not developed, like someone being brought up in a normal environment. So you have this hypervigilance and fight or flight mode or freeze. So when you're getting beat up, or this emotional neglect, or you're seeing your mum being beat up, or you're witnessing this, that, there's a fight or flight, and that as a chemical reaction within the brain. And then the brain is because of this is constant, the brain is not developing as normal. So we're prone to impulsivity, our emotions, dealing with our emotions, we find it difficult. So then you start to have like the mental health sides where you don't think you're good enough. You don't think you're lovable. You go into relationships and you question the relationships. You get insecure and start looking at your partner and think you don't love me or you're going to cheat on me. And it's because back when you were a child, there's some sort of adverse childhood experiences that's happened. And that could be, you know, not being told you're loved and cuddled and touched, because these are all important things when we're growing up. You know, this can happen in the pregnancy as well. If your mother is being pregnant and she's in violence or drinking, this has an effect on you as you grow up. So it's massive. I heard something on here. It's about 85%, 90% of the population in America have all been through adverse childhood experiences. So there's a pandemic of adverse childhood experiences, and we need as a nation and a society to tackle this, because it's a strain on the NHS, it's a strain on the prison system, it's a strain on society, and it's a strain on that individual, and it needs to stop.
Yeah, let me just say, you know, Matt Parker, who's one of our guys, works in a school. He said a quarter of children experience at least one, and I reckon that's a very conservative estimate. And what I have to say as well is the strange thing about these adverse childhood experiences is you might feel completely fine doing something which people would normally be fearful of, like using drugs or getting into fights, but stuff like settling down in a relationship, paying bills, might absolutely terrify you. So it really does have a strange effect on people. I mean, I personally, like, I still feel I carry the scars for stuff that goes back years. And but that brings me, that's kind of a segue to this kind of 12-step thing. You heard about the 12-step thing. You get involved in the 12-step thing. Tell us what happens, because I am conscious of time, and we really want to be talking also about the work of the Well. And I did some research on you. I think you're involved in 7 charities at board level, which is quite interesting.
There's a few things involved in
that. Yeah. Tell us about the 12-step program. What happened?
So I'll quickly, you know, I got to the Lancaster prison, and the first person and the first people I see in there when I get on the rehab wing is people I've grew up in the prison since I was 16 to 30 odd years of age. And one of them was saying, there's a new way, there's a way out. No longer do we have to suffer a life of addiction and crime. You know, there's hope. And I thought, wow. And I said, Will it stop the chaos and the madness in my mind? Because that's, I can't live with me. That's my problem. I can't live with me, so I have to find drugs to shut me up, to shut my mind up. That's the only solution I have. And he said, no, honestly, it will set you free. And I looked at this 12-step program and the promises, and it says, if you follow this spiritual, non-religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous, you never have to use again. And it was like, whoa, wow, no one's ever told me that before. And I made a decision then, I am going to commit to this program. And the only way they're going to get me off is they kick me off. And I committed to that program, and I've never used since. But what happened in them first couple of months is I started picking up.
How long ago was that?
That was 15 years ago, just over 15 years. And I started to go to the church as well, in the chapel, and they gave me a Bible. And I was reading my Bible in a dorm of 8 men, prisoners. And I was reading this Bible, and it started to penetrate, and it started to hit me what was happening, and it was like God was knocking on my door. So I turned around and I said, okay then, if you're there right now, come into my life. No shit, come into my life right now. And at that moment, the Holy Spirit come into my life, and I had an experience that you can't articulate. you're trying to explain, but you haven't got words to explain it because it doesn't explain the experience that happened. But the Holy Spirit come into my life then, and I experienced something that's my foundation.
That when what did I'm, it feel like?
My body become alive. It was like a floating sensation. It was like a tingly. It was full of joy. It was full of happiness. There was no words. There was no. It was just like. I don't know, but I suppose God is very clever. But because if he just give it out like that, we would all be doing it. Yeah, I suppose. And sometimes we just need faith, because there's different kinds of coming to God. And I don't want to say that this is like the holy grail of coming to God, because it's not. There's different experiences. But I am he knows my mind. And if you tell me that's a chair, I don't believe you until you get the chair out and I knock it and I look at it and go, oh, that's a chair. Okay, I touch. And that's the only way I would have come to God. I couldn't have come through the educational kind. I needed to have an experience, because I wouldn't have believed. And that experience. And the next day, I didn't wake up honest. I didn't wake up whacking people with the Bible and shouting, Jesus is the Messiah and all this, that and the other. And I sulkily went up to the chapel and said, Carolyn, Carolyn was the pastor. I said, I've had this experience. I don't really know what it was. Something's happened to me. I said, come into my life. She was like, oh, it's God. It's the Holy Spirit. But what I believe I was blessed with, God come into my life, and then he's given me a 12-step program to work out and get rid of all the rubbish that I've had inside me that's blocked me off, that I've been lost. To self, to me family, to society, I was lost. And he gave me this program to work through that, where now, you know, I was lost, but now I'm found and now I'm set free. And, you know, I practiced my faith in prison. I done the Alpha courses, I done the studies in there, the book studies. And I have never felt so free in my life behind a closed door, behind a prison door, ever, ever. Because I had this relationship and it was like absolutely, you know I have a direct line to God. I have a direct line. I don't have to go to anyone else. He's blessed me with a direct line that I can go to him, and I get on my knees and I pray to him. And without him in my life right now, I don't know where I'd be. And that's the truth. I don't know where I'd be. And I'd hate to not have a power like God in my life right now. Imagine not having God in your life. It's like, whoa, you know, and you know, he's guided me. I've just walked this path. I don't know how I've got here with the world. I just walked this path. He puts people in, he puts things in my place, and I walk through the doors, I meet the people, and I read the stuff, and I just, things just happen. So I was in that prison for 2.5 years, and that's where I met Kenny Mayo. You know, I become a peer supporter in there, and like all the prison staff, one of them, my key workers, said, nah, I don't believe you. I think you'll be using when you get out, and you know, you're just doing this for your parole. I said, I don't want my parole, I'll never get my parole, because all the violence with prison officers and stuff like that. But anyone who had a problem, they would send them to me. And I think Kenny lost his, I think it was your mother, Kenny, or your dad, forgive me, but I know you lost a parent. And they sent you to me. They said, go and have a word with Dave Iam. So Kenny Mayo come to me cell, and we went off together. And I just talked to him. I just supported him. And we've become friends ever since. So I met Kenny Mayo in Lancaster Castle when he had a bereavement. And, So I've become the person. It was his mum. So I've become the person people send them to me, and I just support them and love them and try and just help them. And then, you know, I was getting out, and people who were getting out before me kept coming back into prison. And it was like, what the hell's going on? Like, when they got out the door, they said they had faith. And when they got out, the faith had gone. So I was like, what's this prison faith all about? Do you know what I mean? People had prison faith, and I try and study that. What is prison faith? People had prison recovery and got out and used the same day, and it was like, Wow. So I had this big fear I was going to use. So the day I got out, the chaplaincy, I didn't want to go back to Liverpool.
Dave, you have to stop there just for a second, right? So just because I've got an idea where you're going. So, and we need to get to founding the well. And I know that this is going to come from that, but some people would say about the 12-step recovery program, one issue they would have, that there is two issues that you often hear. One is the fact that you identify yourself with your addiction, and it'd be good to hear what your answer would be there. And the other thing was, Kenny says you were glowing. Ollie, this is where the question comes from. Big shout out to Ollie. He's one of our boys. 12 steps, you will want for nothing because you will have it all inside. Others would say it's not just identifying with your addiction, you know, hey, my name's Steve and I'm a drug user. The other issue people might have is it's quite long going. So I've not used drugs for a long, long time. So I don't, for me personally, you know, I've still got loads of other issues, but, you know, some people would have a problem with the fact that a lot of people within recovery stay within recovery. Do you want to answer those two questions?
Yeah. And it's a common thing. And you think people say, oh, you're codependent and you're labeling yourselves and this, this, and the other, like you know, you're enslaved to this way of life. And, you know, now after 15 years of studying and looking at different pathways, because there is different pathways to recovery. It's not just about 12 steps. There's people that, you know, drug and alcohol free without the 12 steps, and people are free through faith. You know, there's loads of different ways. But I think one of the things for someone who's been through a lot of trauma and a lot of, you know, adverse childhood experiences, they don't feel like they fit in. Yep. They don't feel they belong around normal people because we don't think like you. We don't think like you. And the thoughts we've had. So when I feel like I can get random thoughts around, just drive your car into the wall and kill yourself, and you know what I mean? Just do these random stuff. And, you know, you've got these kind of, you know, it's from abuse and stuff like that. So it's hard to fit in to normal society. So when you see someone that speaks your language and they've recovered, and you build a friendship up and you build a fellowship. So it's like saying about the church, saying, why do you still go to church? You've got God in your life. Why do you still go on a Sunday? Because it empowers me when I go on a Sunday, and that fellowship keeps me alive and keeps my faith strong. So why do you go to a meeting? Well, when I go, I get power. When I go, I like to go to help someone else. So I like to give back. So when we go to church, we preach and we talk about God. So we're giving back to the newcomer, to the new person walking in the door in church. And then we have our family, don't we? Family church. So, you know, stay within the church or you'll be wrongly yoked. Stay within the fellowship and you'll be rightly yoked, and you'll be, you know, be getting that power. So when you look at, for me, the 12 steps is a bridge to normal living. So in order for me to stay honest, to stay kind, caring, empathic, supportive, loving, I need some sort of program. I need some sort of continuing, because today I could get up and I've had lack of sleep last night and I've woke up early. I can become short on patience, short on tolerance. Now, I can pray and say, oh, God will do it. Or the best advice I got was put legs on your prayers. Yeah. So I'm going to put legs on my prayers, and I'm going to sit with another recovering addict and say, look, I'm struggling. I'm coming across a bit frustrated. What is it? Well, she said that, and it was like, well, you know, you step one where you're powerless over people, places, and situations. Oh, yeah, that powerless stuff, that I can't change what she does. I can only change myself. Yeah. Well, just change yourself and work on yourself. Ah, that's it. So that's how I'm not going to come. So I'm in this like fellowship that is a love and supportive community of people. Now, some people grow out of that and go, and that's okay. You know, there's no judgment on that. And it's like, but it's a community of people. It's a fellowship of people. And it's like going to church. When you go to a meeting, it's like going to church on a Sunday. And that's the best analogy I can give you. And then the steps is like the Bible. Go home and read your Bible. Go home and do your step work. But not only that, you need the power. So, you know, for me, it's God. I go to church. And some people go to church, some people don't in the fellowship. They use the peers within the groups as their power, you know, their power greater than themselves. And it's like, you know, individually, if I'm left on my own with my thinking, I'll end up in Kathmandu somewhere. You know, that way water can't get, I'd end up there.
What I would say is, you know, it's not the tool, it's a tool, and everybody needs their boys. My boy, Jamie Haxby, stuck this comment, great microphone placement there, Steve. Yeah, I did that for you. I hope you can hear me loud and clear, Haxby. Dave, talk to me about the well. And let me just say, you know, Dave comes across as a law-abiding citizen, but I was listening to one of his things, and he was charging his volunteers to volunteer when the WOW first began. And I'm sure there are employment laws against that. So if you do work for the police force or you are an informer, that's just between us and you. So tell us about the WOW.
Yes. Can you see me? Yeah.
Yeah. I can see you.
Yeah. So when I got released from prison in Lancaster, there was two fellowship meetings with about two or three people attending. Sometimes I'd sit there on my own. There was no recovery. And the people that were in it, there was no real, like, fellowship outside the meeting. Fellowship in terms of going for brews, doing this, that, and the other. And it was like, bloody hell, this is our town. And there's nothing here. There's two meetings. Everyone was travelling to Blackpool, to Birmingham, and to Blackburn, Accrington and Preston to go to meetings for a decent meeting. So I had that in the back of my mind. Now, that's not right. We should have, recovery in our own town. And I said, well, what do I want to do? I'm good at helping people. I'm good at seeing things and creating things. But I'm here with volunteering in a charity shop in the Salvation Army. I've got a little bedroom in a loft. I've got no money, but I want to work in recovery. What do I have to do? Well, you have to go to college. You're going to have to learn. You're going to have to educate yourself, and you're going to have to volunteer. So I volunteered 5 days a week, drug services, secondhand shops. And I used to shop. It was a bit selfish because I had no money, nothing. So I was volunteering at the second-hand shop, and I'd get first dibs on the clothes that come in. So I would always look for brands and say, I love this and I love that. So it was good to be with. That's where, you know, the water comes from as well. So I'd get the opportunity. So I volunteered everywhere, and I watched and I learned. So someone who's never worked in their life, someone who's never had their own accommodation, I've never had a bank account, I've never had a driving license, never been on a plane, never been on a holiday. I've never had nothing. I've been in addiction from the age of 12 right to 37. So when I was volunteering, I'd watch the staff, and I'd watch how they talk to the clients. I'd watch how they conducted themselves in the office, how they spoke, how they moved. And I'd be like, okay. I'd ask people what's the current reading. So I'd read on what recovery is and what addiction is. And he had some good mentors, really, in that time. So I was reading all this stuff. And then about a year and a half, I went for a job, and I got a job in a therapeutic rehab in Blackburn called, it was in Meadows at the time, and I think it's called Whitnall House now. Whitnall House, and it was the one from Walter Lyon, so it was the same one from Walter Lyon. They had Walter Lyon and then one in Chorley. So I worked there, and then, you know, I was turning the deep end, and then I learned to work with the lads, and then I started bringing different groups, and the guys were just blown away by the groups I would introduce. And so I went from there, then I went and I learned from there because I was 12 step. some of the staff didn't like me.
Okay.
They didn't like me. They thought like, oh, 12-step, get away, spiritual gods and this, that and the other. So we had a difficult time there. I was bullied, to be fair, in that environment. But I learned from there that every bad experience I learned and I've took and created the well. So I wanted a place where you could walk out the office and no one was talking about you. Because the minute I walked out the office, they would talk. And I asked them, I said, I feel you're talking about me when I walk out the office. He said, we are. Okay. So it was that blunt, you know what I mean? So I ended up left there and got a promotion job to a key worker in the community. So I was working in Skem, Preston, Chorley, Leyland, setting groups up. Then we got TP'd over to an organisation called Lifeline. And at that time, I presented a model of recovery for Central Lancashire and said, I think this is how it should all fit in. This is what the model should be like and the pathways. And I presented it to the service manager and said, this is what we should be running in Central Lancashire. And she went, we love it. Let's implement it. I said, we will do it if you give me a promotion to the recovery lead. So she went, okay, we'll give you the promotion to the recovery lead of Central Lancashire. So I got promoted there, and then we started delivering that group. And you know, that was in Preston, so I was in the central hub there. And I remember Pete Yarwood at the time just got a job as the Luff. So you know, I said, I'll support you in that. So we used to bring all our guys went for the first Luff meetings and bring them all down to Preston, and it was vibrant. The recovery was vibrant. So I learned all my skills on the way, but I also knew that services were too inward facing. They were like getting people in service. I said, we need to be in the community. We need to be out there and integrated in the community, because that's where people really recover. So I got cherry picked to go and work in Lancaster with another organisation, and then I got approached again to come a manager for another organisation. So I went to there to work with all probation across Merseyside, across Cumbria, and then I got promoted to the regional manager to manage service user engagement across the northwest and then into Leeds as well. So I was doing that, but all the time I wanted to do the well, because that's where recovery is. So this was in 2012, and all the hubs and all the community stuff weren't about then. It just weren't about. I had this idea, and they thought I was crazy to open something on a weekend. So I ended up in 2000. So I started the well, and I had no funding, no nothing. And I said to the provider I was working with, yeah, I'll set this idea up and we can get involved together. And he said, no, we can't pay you to work on weekends. I said, I'll give an afternoon off for nothing and do it. And he went, no, we don't want none of that. And I went, okay. So I'm blessed and thankful that they never, because it might have been within that organization and it mightn't have been what it was. So,
but before we go back there, Stuart Nevin says he remembers the early days, and that you guys have come a long way. He said you've come a long way, fella. So a big shout out to Stuart Nevin. Thank you for your comment.
Yes, Stu. Yeah, and Stu's been there from the beginning. He used to come all the time, Stuart. And
did you make him pay to volunteer?
He's been volunteering a few times, but I think. So we had this idea, and they needed to pay the rent, so I thought, you know what, I'll put my own money in. So I put my own money in. When I paid the rent for a couple of months, and I said, well, how are we going to sustain ourselves? So I went and asked a few volunteers, do you want to volunteer? And they said, yeah. And I said, brilliant, this is the idea, and this is what I want to do, but there's a catch. And they said, what's that? You're going to have to pay £2.50 to volunteer to get in the door. But we'll give you a free cup of tea and a free coffee and stuff like that. So I was paying it £2.50. Kerry was, and the volunteers. And we all put £2.50 in the pot. And that was just wiping its face. Do you know what I mean? Because we all given our time. I had a full-time job and was doing this as well. And then I got some funding from the Brick at the time, £5,000. I put a bid in and I thought, right, let's pay the rent for the year. So I paid the rent for the year and said, right, everyone could come in free. So we all come in free and in the Lancaster Boys and Girls Club, and we were just connected. All it was, there was no even great big plan. It was just about, I wanted to help my community. So I opened the well and I went round. So when I was in meetings in Blackpool, I seen key people from Lancaster in these meetings, and I challenged them and I said, what are you doing in this meeting? And he went, what do you mean? I went, we're struggling back in Lancaster. You need to get back to Lancaster and get service in Lancaster, because you've got service in Blackpool, you've got service in friggin' Preston, and we're struggling. I'm sitting on my own and another girl sitting on their own in meetings, and they come back and they come back to Lancaster. And then I started, like, me and Kerry would say, right, let's go for food, let's go for meals, let's come back to our house. And we started to get fellowship going again. So, you know, I'm not saying it's all down to me or Kerry, or, but it needed someone to trigger people to get them back to our town. So we got them back, and then it took off. It just took off from there.
So where is the well today, and what does she do? And Kerry's his wife. Kerry's his wife, for those who are tuning in later and haven't caught this from the beginning and don't know Dave. Kerry's his wife, so send some love out for Kerry. Where is the well today, and what do you guys do?
Yeah. Well, the well today, from like that, so the well today, from, you know, we have to turn over about, I think it was £25 a week, something like that, or a fortnight or something like that, just on tea and coffee, do you know what I mean? And it was like, and we were all just volunteers, and from that, you know, when Stuart was there, and Michael Greenfield, Foxy, you know, loads of different people there, and we just, it just evolved, and I was doing two jobs, Callum as well, and I ended up getting a bit of lottery money, £10,000 for people to work in the well. So I had a full-time job, and I said, well, I don't want it. And I said, so I give it to Callum and Michael Greenfield, and said, right, these are your first jobs. And this was their first jobs in recovery, do you know what I mean? And they were buzzing, so they had jobs in there, and it was like, this was all just pouring in. So for the first 3 years, I don't think people, you know, remember this, so three or four years, I was there not getting any pay. This is pure just loving my community, and, you know, I'd make sure all the lads got jobs and all this, that and the other, until there was an opportunity come that I negotiated a contract in 2016 for Through the Gate, and you know, I managed to get enough money to set up recovery housing in Barrow, because I used to sell drugs in Barrow when I was from Liverpool. So I was one of them scousers going up. And it was that moment I made the decision. I thought, right, I'm leaving this job and I'm going to commit to the well. And I committed to the well, and we haven't looked back. Now we have 23 staff. We have 8 properties. We have 28 bed properties. We're commissioned to run drug-related death across North and Central Lancashire. We're commissioned to do recovery hubs across North and Central Lancashire. We're commissioned to go into the hospital working with dual diagnosis in Lancaster Hospital and Fairness General Hospital. We're commissioned to go into the prisons and deliver group work, 12 steps and behavioural change, and then do the Through the Gate. But, you know, there's one thing from all my experiences. I wanted an organisation that was not the hierarchy, you know, and a dictatorship, and I wanted it to be a loving environment where it's like, where this is the real deal. This is the real deal. We're in it to save lives. We're in it to help people, you know. And I said, when you're in meetings, don't think you can say I'm helping people because you're working for the well. That's not helping people. You're getting paid to do that. Go and help them and do your service outside of work. So I have to do mine. So I have to come to work and help people, and then I do it in service, in meetings and outside the meetings. But I do it, you know, in meetings, outside the meetings, and in work. And I wanted to create a culture where it was loving people. We just want to love people until they love themselves. We're going to love you until you love yourself. And we've created an environment, a culture, where you can walk out the office and no one's going to bitch about you. If you're struggling with your job, you can put your hands up and the whole community will rally around you to help you in your role. It's not, this is not my job. Yes, it is. We don't walk around with lanyards and saying I'm the chief exec and the founder. I'm just Dave Iron. I'll just walk in and just be one of the lads with them. I don't have to tell them I'm the boss. They already know that. I do it with love. If I need someone to do something for me, I'll say, can you do me a favor, please? You know, that is the environment of our staff, and the staff love it. The well won't walk away from you. You will walk away from us. And it'll be your own behavior that makes you walk away, because we make you look at your own self, because we will mirror, because we all try and be accountable. We all be honest and we'll be truthful. And if you're not doing what's right, because if you're working at the well, you've got to be a role model. Because you can't come in here and chat a cracker and pretend you're living a good life and an honest life. You've got to live it, because if you're not, you're going to get challenged. But what that creates is a real loving environment where people care and people want to go out and help save lives.
Dave, we're going to turn to you in a little moment, and I want you to give a closing statement. Two things dealing with, like, what did being locked up teach you about how to deal with lockdown? So keep it short and keep it punchy. And the second thing is, what advice would you give to those with addictions, or to those who have family and friends with addictions? So as Dave's just thinking about that, let me just say, guys, make sure you're smashing that love button for Dave Chaim and The Well. Make sure you're sharing this post as well, because the more you share it, the more people can see it. Once we finish, remember in the description bar, you've got our details. That's Hope Church Lancaster. We do Something More podcasts every Monday night, and we're dealing with about how to be better as human beings and how to make humanity better. So you can punch like on our page as well. But that's it from me. Dave, I'm going to go to you. You're going solo. What did being locked up teach you about how to deal with lockdown? And if people have got addictions, or if people have got friends or family members with addictions, whether that's food, whether that's substances, whether that's work, because addictions is a huge field, what would your closing statement be to them?
But you can't hear.
Hey Dave, are you there, buddy? It just froze. Dave, are you there? Okay, guys, I think we may have lost him. I'm going to get him on the phone, because I think it's really important that we hear Dave's closing statement. So I'm going to try and phone him. And let's see if we can do this. It's possible that his are you there? Okay, let's try this.
Hello, this is Dave Ryan. I can't get to the phone right now, but if you leave your name and your number.
You got me, Steve.
I have got you. I was going to try and bring you over on the phone. So, Dave, technology. Oh, look, I've lost him again. Let me just look at your comments. He's going to be coming back. Kenny, there's Dave. You are back with us. You're back with us.
Yeah.
Right. Send out some love to Dave Chaim. Guys, if you don't pray, hey, be praying now, because tech, what a nightmare. It was a nightmare to even make this interview happen. And so be sending some love, be praying. Be making sure you smash the like button on the web's Facebook page. Make sure you're subscribing to their YouTube page. Make sure you tick on the Hope Lancaster page so we can keep you filled in. Now, Dave Chaim, hopefully is going to give us his closing statements about lockdown, his advice, practical things, and what would he say to those with addictions and or those who have got family members with addictions. I'm going to come off the screen. If you go off, we're going to try and do this over the phone. So over to you, Dave Higham.
Cheers, Steve. So on lockdown, I think it's important to keep your head focused. And what I try and do every morning is try and meditate or just sit in the garden in the sun, this beautiful sun, going out and just being still and being present and being aware of your surroundings. And it just slows everything down in your mind and really calms yourself down. And it really is good for the day. And you don't have to be working any program. You don't have to be into anything to be able to do that. Because I think it's important just to be still, to just slow your mind down and stop your thinking, really. Slow your thinking down and take that notice. And it helps me just feel grateful and get the gratitude of doing that. I've also, you know, as well as working, like, but I'm also, you know, doing exercise. So I'm doing some exercise in the house with little loose weights. I'm doing that. I'm going on walks. I'm just trying to be active because I've been hitting the food cupboards and that's a no-no. I had a big gut. And I tell you what, the cost of people shopping would be unbelievable because I know we spend a lot and our friends are. So if you can get into the exercise and slow the chocolate down, it'll make you less tired and fatigued. So what would I say to people who are in addiction and you know, maybe sitting there now in the isolation and maybe using, maybe just struggling in recovery and the struggling and, you know, first of all, let's say, you know, to people that are using or trying to stop and keep going back, it's like, don't give in. You know, I was writ off by the police. I was writ off by the probation services. I was writ off by the drug services. I was writ off by my own family. I was writ off by society that man will die in addiction. That man will die. It's like there's no way he's going to get recovery. He's going to break free. And, you know, and I found a way out. I found a way out. And my route was the 12 steps. But it can be, you know, different avenues. But you can break free more so today than any time in history that you have got an opportunity to break free from life of crime and addiction. You can do that because the opportunities that are available now to people is amazing. You know, we're across North Central Cumbria and we've got a whole team with people who lived experience who was there and willing to help and support you. And in the communities, the fellowships are there as well. And it's like, you can recover. And then people who are in recovery and in early days in, it's like you're at the start of your journey. You're at the start of the rest of your life. And it's hard and it's difficult sometimes, but why shouldn't it be? Why wouldn't it be? And why shouldn't it be? Because you've lived a hard life. You've gone through some difficult times. You've gone through real struggles. And you're not just going to walk by that unscathed. You know, you've got to go in there and delve in and have a look at this stuff and break free and address it, face it, walk through it and break free and leave that behind. You can take the rucksack off that weighs you down. You know, it's hard, but it's worth it. It's really worth it because today, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And for one minute, I would never, ever thought I would get that. I would always look outside and say, everyone else is going to get this. Everyone will get this, but not me. Because I had that why me, why poor me attitude all the time. But I'm sitting here today as one of the, you know, prolific offenders, you know, just, as I said, you know, writ off by all providers, all services, all family members, and I have recovered, and you can recover too, you know, and it's amazing. Life is really good. Life is really good, and there's people out there that want to love you, And I want to say, we will love you until you love yourself. You know, break free from the addiction, break free from the crime, face your trauma, face your aces. Don't be a prisoner to this thing that's happened years ago. You know, you can face it, forgive and move on. I have forgiven and I have moved on, and I have a wonderful life. I have a wonderful family, and I am so blessed right now, and you too can. So come on, man, step up. Let's have it. Let's have it. Make the decision today to stay right from here on in. I'm going to change my life and do whatever it takes. Like I said when I done that rehab, I am not leaving here until you kick me out. And here I am, still clean. You today can make that change now and say, I'm going to make an effort and put the action in. I'm not going to stop until I get the life beyond my wildest dreams. And I'm sitting here and I can say, wow, I love this, what I've got, you know. And I just hope and pray that you make that decision and you get a life beyond your wildest dreams.
Dave Higham, an absolute pleasure. You know, I didn't even ask you, what is your favorite Beatles song? That's me being stereotypical about Scousers, isn't it? What's your favorite Beatles song? You have to answer it quickly, because I need to let these guys go.
I'd have to think. There's so many. Maybe Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Okay, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. You heard it here first. Guys, we so love you. And if you need anything from Hope Church Lancaster, or if you need anything from The Well, make sure you let us know. But God bless you and take care of yourself. Bye, guys.
Peace out.